Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations, Religion, and Foreign Policy Conference Call series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Thank you all for joining us. Today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website at www.cfr.org. We're delighted to have the United States Commission on International Religious Freedoms, Katrina Lantos-Sweat and Elizabeth Cassidy with us to talk about the findings of the Commission's 2013 annual report. Katrina Lantos-Sweat serves as chair of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, which is an independent U.S. government advisory body established by Congress to monitor religious freedom worldwide and make policy recommendations to the President, the Secretary of State, and Congress. Dr. Lantos-Sweat is the founder and president of the Lantos Foundation for Human Rights and Justice. In addition to managing the foundation, she teaches human rights and American foreign policy at Tufts University. Elizabeth Cassidy serves as the deputy director for policy and research at USCIRF. Before coming to the commission, Ms. Cassidy was the assistant executive director of UN Watch, where she monitored UN affairs. She's taught at Princeton University, Seton Hall University School of Law, and the University of Namibia. Katrina and Elizabeth, thank you both for joining us today. Katrina, it would be great if we could start with you to just give us an overview, set the stage of the commission and this report that you've produced.
Well, thank you very much, Irina, and really congratulations and thanks to you and your team who work on these wonderful national programs. We are particularly grateful at USCIRF to again have the opportunity to share our findings from our recently released 2013 annual report. USCIRF appreciates this ongoing cooperation with the Council on Foreign Relations, and we look forward to it continuing in the future. And welcome to all of the participants who are listening. I look forward to chatting with you as the conversation goes on. So most of us who are currently serving as USCIRF commissioners, the year covered by this report that was just released was our first year on the commission. And it has also coincided with my term as USCIRF chair, which will shortly be coming to an end, although I am very pleased that I will be continuing to serve as a U.S. commissioner in the coming year. Honestly, this past year has been both a joy and a challenge, as my colleagues and I have labored together with USCIRF's very able staff in confronting violations of freedom of religion or belief worldwide and developing policy recommendations to advise the President, the Secretary of State, and the Congress. Despite these efforts and this focus, I'm saddened to say that the picture looks bleak as persecution and repression continue to affect billions of our fellow human beings all around the world. The State Department's recently released report on religious freedom, which is sort of a companion to our own, unfortunately supports this grim assessment. Religious freedom violators are equal opportunity oppressors, targeting a wide range of victims, from Rohingya Muslims in Burma to Coptic Christians in Egypt, from Buddhists, Uyghur Muslims, and Protestant house church members in the Falun Gong in China, to the Baha'is in Iran, from Ahmadis and Christians in Pakistan, to Muslims in Muslim-majority nations like Saudi Arabia and Uzbekistan, and in non-Muslim nations like Russia. The bottom line is, real people suffer when the right of religious freedom is violated. And this suffering is occurring, frankly, in far too many countries. And let me just give you a few examples from our report. With the president recently meeting with Burma's president, I think that would be a good place to start. Burma is a place where, despite political reforms, sectarian violence and severe abuses continue with impunity against ethnic minority Christians and Muslims. In neighboring China, we observed this year the further deterioration of religious freedom conditions, particularly for Tibetan Buddhists and Uyghur Muslims. Repression continues of independent Catholic and Protestant groups, as well as members of the Falun Gong. Another very pressing example is that of Egypt. Despite some progress after Mubarak, the government has repeatedly failed to protect religious minorities, including Coptic Christians, from violence, while prosecuting and jailing people for so-called defamation of religion. The other area we have of great concern in Egypt is that the new constitution includes some very problematic provisions on religious freedom. We have the example of Nigeria, which continues to falter in protecting religious freedom. The terrorist group Boko Haram attacked Christians as well as fellow Muslims who opposed them. And the Nigerian government has repeatedly failed to prosecute perpetrators of religiously related violence that has killed more than 14,000 Nigerians, both Christian and Muslim. Turning to Pakistan, arguably one of the worst situations for religious freedom in the world, religious freedom abuses have risen dramatically due to chronic sectarian violence targeting the Shia community. The government's continued failure to protect Christians, Ahmadis, and Hindus, along with its incredibly repressive blasphemy law and anti-Ahmadi laws, have fueled religious freedom abuses and vigilante violence. A final example is Russia, where conditions continue to worsen as the government uses extremism laws against certain Muslim groups and so-called non-traditional religious communities, particularly Jehovah's Witnesses. They utilize raids, detentions, and imprisonment. In addition to this massive violations are continuing in Chechnya, and outside of Russia, a similar repression occurs across Central Asia as well. Now, in response to the violations, the United States can play a leadership role by using all of the tools at its disposal to press for change. As a first step, USCIRF urges the State Department to promptly designate the worst violators of religious freedom as countries of particular concern. And that's sort of a term of art in the IRFA statute. And we urge the state to leverage these designations to encourage improvements in these countries. CPC, or Country of Particular Concern status, is a creation of the International Religious Freedom Act of 98, which established USCIRF as well as our sister office at the State Department. In this report, we recommend that the State Department redesignate the following eight countries as countries of particular concern. So the existing CPC countries that we call on state to redesignate are the following. Excuse me. Burma, China, Eritrea, Iran, North Korea, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, and Uzbekistan. For these eight currently designated countries, we also urge the State Department to utilize the CPC designation as a mechanism to help these countries find pathways towards ending these abuses and implementing reforms. Now, in this year's report, USCIRF also found that seven other countries meet the CPC threshold and should be so designated. And those seven countries are Egypt, Iraq, Nigeria, Pakistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Vietnam. Together, in our view, these 15 countries comprise our Tier 1 list and really represent the most severe violators of religious freedom globally. We have also placed eight additional countries on our Tier 2 list, which replaces our watch list designation from previous years. And those eight countries are Afghanistan, Azerbaijan, Cuba, India, Indonesia, Kazakhstan, Laos, and Russia. We found that the abuses in these countries are serious enough to meet at least one of the three criteria, but not all of the statutory criteria, which are that a country has to have systemic, ongoing, and egregious religious freedom violations in order to meet the CPC benchmark language. We think the Tier 2 designation gives policymakers advance warning to enable, we hope, preventative diplomacy. Besides documenting abuses and formulating recommendations for Tier 1 and Tier 2 countries, our annual report also highlights and spotlights countries and regions where current trends are worth monitoring. Some of these include Bahrain, Bangladesh, Belarus, Ethiopia, Turkey, Venezuela, and Western Europe. And this year's report also addresses several themes relating to religious freedom, ranging from legal retreat from religious freedom in post-communist countries, to severe religious freedom violations by non-state actors. And I should add that recently USERF released a separate report on religious freedom conditions in Syria, including recommendations as to how our government can help Syriac, Christian, and Alawite minorities, as well as members of the Sunni majority. Now, based on our efforts over the past year, one cross-cutting issue that we observe is the growing challenge of violent religious extremism, in which religion is hijacked to advance radical agendas by force. Since USERF's mandate includes encouraging Washington to hold other governments accountable for religious freedom abuses, we look at religious extremism through the lens of government actions or inactions. In other words, through sins of commission and omission, governments are responsible for religious freedom abuses within their borders, including those driven by violent religious extremism. Such abuses are harmful not only to human rights, but also to the stability of their societies and other countries. Indeed, studies show convincingly that countries that honor religious freedom enjoy greater stability, harmony, and prosperity, while those whose governments perpetrate or tolerate violations create the conditions for failed societies. So when it comes to violent religious extremism, religious freedom abuses not only offend human rights, but they pose a grave threat to the security and stability of countries. And unfortunately, this instability and violence often spills beyond national borders into neighboring countries, threatening entire regions. Look, as Americans living in a post-9/11 world, we of all people know what happens when violent religious extremism is exported globally in the form of terrorism. This is why the U.S. government must prioritize religious freedom, not just as a core human right, but also as a global security imperative and a vital part of any counter-extremism strategy. Our government must recognize the pivotal role of religion in countries that top our foreign policy agenda and how limitations on religious liberty can harm entire societies. Religious freedom has national security relevance. Conditions favoring it can help counter extremism by undercutting the message of extremists and fostering religious diversity and minority rights. As a fundamental right, religious freedom is a core component of a healthy society, as it encompasses other key freedoms, including those of expression, association, and assembly. Now, in order to further the religious freedom agenda, our commission recommends the following. We would like to see the Obama administration issue a national security strategy on supporting religious freedom abroad, combining all U.S. government activities in a whole-of-government effort to confront this challenge. We think Congress should hold hearings and embrace legislation that prioritizes religious freedom and reflects its critical importance to national security and global stability. The State Department should prioritize this pivotal freedom by pressing countries to implement reforms that will confront extremism and protect liberty. And the State Department should also make CPC designation soon, and obviously we believe it should expand its list of named countries. We recommend the State Department make CPC designations. We had recommended to them that they make CPC designations when they released in May their religious freedom report. Unfortunately, at that time, they did not. With no CPC designations in almost 2 years, the clock is ticking. The U.S. government's actions against the currently designated countries will expire in August if no action is taken. Look, naming countries as CPCs isn't the end of engagement, but rather the beginning of a high-level process to encourage governments to improve. When combined with the prospect of sanctions or other actions, the CPC designation can create political will where none existed, moving repressive governments to undertake needed changes. Failing to act by August would, we think, send a terrible message about the commitment of the United States to this important issue. So let me bring my sort of introductory remarks to a conclusion here. I want to stress to all of you that despite the bleak picture we see of religious freedom abroad, progress remains possible and there is a crucial role for the United States to play. We know change will not happen overnight, but if Washington truly supports free and vibrant marketplaces of ideas, including religious freedom ideas, I believe that in spite of many obstacles, the desire for a better life on the part of hundreds of millions of our fellow human beings is ultimately going to prevail. So thank you, and let me stop there, and I look forward to engaging in a dialogue and discussion with you.
Thank you very much, Katrina. Elizabeth, over to you.
Just briefly, thanks, Katrina, for giving a great overview of the report. I don't want to take a lot of time, so I want to be able to open it up to questions, but I just want to thank Katrina, and for those who don't know, our commissioners are private sector and our volunteers, so we really appreciate all the hard work that Katrina and the other commissioners put into this effort. As you might imagine, producing this report is quite an endeavor. So with that, why don't we just open it up for questions and we can talk about what the listeners are interested in.
Wonderful. Thank you. Okay, so let's open up for questions and comments from the group.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions and comments. If you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please press the star key followed by the 1 key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the queue, press star 2. Again, please press star 1 to ask a live question or make a live comment. Our first question comes from Keith Wood with the UN Human Rights Council.
Hello there. I'm actually representing the International Humanist and Ethical Union at the UN Human Rights Council. And I just wanted to draw attention to the traditional religious practices that are mentioned under Western Europe at the bottom of page 282 and the top of page 283. And those traditional religious practices are male circumcision and ritual slaughter. And they're being challenged by people with legitimate secular goals, I believe, for example, on grounds of animal and child welfare, rather than by religious hostility. And in practical terms, the European Union is considering a proposal for food labelling, and my own organisation, the International Humanist and Ethical Union, has submitted a paper to the UN on male circumcision. Now, several Western European societies are slowly and very carefully working through these issues, which are very important to both sides, and they're trying to establish whether religious freedom is in fact sufficient grounds for justifying their continued practice of these religious traditions, or whether they violate health and welfare or other rights sufficiently to be grounds for limiting the religious practice. And my question is, isn't this how such completing claims should be considered in rights-based democracies? But I suspect that many will interpret what's in the report as being implying that the US regards this as an example of religious tolerance. And if I'm wrong, I really would like you to make that clearer in future reports. My very final point is that the United Kingdom, which is criticised quite a bit, has, most lawyers agree, the most comprehensive anti-discrimination laws in the world. Thank you.
Well, you know, thank you for a very thoughtful question, and I think you point to what is undoubtedly going to be an area of increasing challenge in the coming years, because when we seek to strike the balance and sort of thread the needle between providing robust protection for religious beliefs, religious freedom, religious practices, there are increasingly going to be instances when that comes into a degree of conflict with secular values or with emerging consensuses in societies that are trying to sort of balance those competing claims. But I think that in the case of, long-standing and very fundamental religious practices that are core to certain key religious communities' ability to practice their faith, yes, I think we would say that religious freedom grounds are sufficient for continuing these practices, and that, worthy secular goals, whether it may relate to health laws or whatever, must not be permitted to ride roughshod over long-standing, scripturally based and time-honored practices of major religious communities. And I think, of course, you know, when we're talking about, you know, things that that pertain to, you know, circumcision and ritual slaughter, these are not minor aspects of the religious observance of the involved communities. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Elizabeth.
Well, I do commend anyone to look at the medical and human rights lawyers' information we've provided to the United Nations Human Rights Council, and that could be sought through Google from the International Humanist and Ethical Union. The documents I'll leave that. I'm sure you can find it from Google. Thank you.
I'm sure you can. Thank you so much.
And just the only thing I would add is a point of clarification. You you asked if this report was the position of the United States. Just to make very clear, USERF is a body that was created by Congress, but we're not part of the State Department. We're not part of the executive branch. We're an advisory body. So our report is speaking for USERF. You'd have to ask the State Department or the administration what the U.S. government position on this is.
Thank you. Next question or comment?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Matt Cherry with the International Humanist and Ethical Union.
I believe that's who we just heard from. No?
Well, yes. You heard from my colleague, Keith. I'm also representing the International Humanist and Ethical Union, and I'm the president of the NGO Committee on Freedom of Religion or Belief at the UN. My question is, first of all, I want to congratulate you on another excellent report, and thank you in particular for giving what I think is a greater emphasis than some past reports to the rights and concerns of non-religious people who are often persecuted, particularly in your appendix on blasphemy laws. I was very pleased to see that. My question is, regarding one particular country, which is the Maldives, which has absolutely no religious freedom. It requires every citizen to be a practicing Muslim and threatens those who would leave Islam or who would even call for a more moderate interpretation of Islam, threatens them with death. And we have seen cases of Maldivians being threatened with death unless they say they are true Muslims and actually killing themselves rather than do that. And I wonder why this country has not been covered in any of your reports and why there's not a cause for concern for U.S. foreign policy.
Elizabeth, I'm going to let you respond on that one.
Sure, I can take that. Yes, you're right. You know, the Maldives, in a way, the situation is legally, you know, similar to Saudi Arabia in terms of the non-recognition of rights to religious freedom and in particular any non-Muslim faith. Just because a country isn't included in our annual report doesn't mean that there aren't any religious freedom violations there. As I've mentioned, our commissioners are part-time. We have a small staff, so we cover some countries, but not all. If you look at the State Department's reporting, you'll see that they do cover the Maldives. So we haven't really taken a good look at that in our annual reports. My colleague who covers that part of the world does sort of keep track of things there, but you know, thus far we haven't highlighted it in our annual reports.
And, you know, our resources, just to supplement what Elizabeth was saying, we're a relatively small commission, so sometimes we do have some choices about where we can to focus our all-too-limited resources. But I want to thank you for recognizing our efforts to underscore a little more fully than in the past that that what we are charged with reporting, so we have tried to be, I think, a little more outspoken in this past year on the rights of those from a secular or humanist perspective to be free from persecution, free from any sort of discrimination societally. And if I'm not mistaken, Elizabeth, I think we also did an op-ed on that subject not too many months ago. So thank you for noting that. We really appreciate that.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Steve Guto with the Jewish Council of Republic Affairs.
Hi. I hope you can hear me because I'm unfortunately on the streets of New York. But in any event,
you're coming through loud and clear.
Excellent. First of all, thank you very much for the work you're doing. Two things. One, in light of the last question, I think it would be good to really clarify, after the comment about the Maldives, that you don't cover the whole world, you know, very clearly, because the egregiousness of what was just described, you know, was pretty upsetting to hear about it. So if you're, you know, I understand limitations of resource, and I respect that. It just seems as if that should be a very clearly said and stated so that nobody would be too shocked when they heard what we just heard. My other question is, what is it that we in America can do to move this agenda forward? Like, what are the hopes you have, and what are the places that we can go to influence or use those people we have that can help on that work to do that work? And how would we go about, you know, learning what it is we can do and how to frame the arguments as well as possible?
Well, that's a great question, and one that I welcome, because my background to some degree is in politics. My late father, Congressman Tom Lantos, was the only Holocaust survivor ever to serve in the United States Congress, and was the founder of the Congressional Human Rights Caucus and served as chair of the House Foreign Relations Committee before he passed away a few years ago.
He was a remarkable presence in our country. Thank you for telling that.
Well, thank you so much for saying that. It means a lot to me. But, you know, I would say that almost the most important thing that people concerned about the state of religious freedom globally can do is, in fact, to reach out to all the branches of our government. So certainly to your leaders in the Senate and in the House. There is a Religious Freedom Caucus in the U.S. House of Representatives. There's a Tom Lantos Commission on Human Rights that gets very engaged in religious freedom issues. You have, you know, the House and the Senate Foreign Relations Committees. Reaching out to the leadership on those committees to say, you know what, religious freedom matters not only as a good and a moral thing for us to stand up for as Americans in its own right, but also because if we look around the world, most of our gravest and most urgent and, frankly, most dangerous foreign policy challenges come from countries where you have violent religious extremism, in part as a result of the repression of religious freedom. So I would strongly encourage any of you passionate or concerned about either our national security or our you know, moral advocacy of religious freedom to sort of engage as citizens with first our Congress, secondly with the administration. You know, just being very current, we now have a new national security advisor who has been named by President Obama today, Ambassador Susan Rice. I think that, you know, I don't know if everybody who was listed as a participant on this call is actually on this call, but if the, you know, nearly 100 who signed up to participate in this call were to email the National Security Agency and say, you know, we welcome and congratulate Ambassador Rice on taking up this new post. Religious freedom is crucial to the national security of the United States, and we urge you to make this a priority. Likewise with the State Department, we have a relatively new Secretary of State. He spoke about and raised the importance of religious freedom in his confirmation testimony, and yet the reality is that, you know, anybody in Washington in a policy-making position often feels overwhelmed by the range of issues sort of beating down on their door for attention. And so it is absolutely the outreach, the engagement, the emails, the phone calls of individuals like yourself that cause the issues we are dealing with to bubble up to the surface. And because, you know, the evidence is just compelling and even overwhelming, the societies that get this piece right, societies that do a good job of providing robust protection for freedom of religion, conscience, and belief tend to get the other things right as well. In that sense, freedom of religion really is sort of a canary in the coal mine. Obviously, if you're going to protect religious freedom, you're going to have a society that protects free speech, protects the right of assembly and of association. You are going. One of the interesting things to me as a sort of a woman activist is that the evidence is very strong that societies that provide good religious freedom protection have higher standards of living and greater societal participation and protection for the women in those societies. So I guess my answer is engagement, activism, speaking out, and in particular reaching out to the White House, the administration, Secretary Kerry, and in particular to the Congress.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from John Chrysaphagus with Greek Orthodox Church.
Yes, I want to thank the two speakers as well and also congratulate you, Ms. Lechosweth, for the report this year. I work closely with the Ecumenical Patriarch. I know you also know Father Alex Karoutsos very well.
Yes.
And we're obviously unsure about maybe the upgrading of Turkey's status, although we're also pleased that there have been developments in Turkey, positive developments.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious what you make of the last few days of protests throughout Turkey, especially in light of what you just mentioned, the close connection between religious freedom and other freedoms. How do you see this impacting on Turkey's status on religious freedom?
Well, it's a very, very powerful and important question. And let me just say, if I may, very briefly addressing what you alluded to, your concerns about what you called the upgrading of Turkey. This was a very, very closely divided vote in many ways. And if you can see that this is a matter of great concern to the commissioners, and there was division about how Turkey should be handled. There seemed to be consensus among the commissioners that Turkey did not meet the CPC standards for the most egregious religious freedom violators, but some felt it merited being on tier two. Others felt that the definition that we were operating under for tier two designation included the requirement that religious persecution and violations of religious freedom were actually increasing, and that sort of is in a way what I think the outcome of that vote hinged on, because we have seen some positive developments on religious freedom. So I just wanted to offer that background.
True, and I could also say that there have been positive developments, and goodness gracious, when you compare with other countries, even that we've heard now this afternoon on this phone conference. So I understand that. I guess our concern is just how much depth there is to the positive steps that we've seen.
And that's a very, very important probing question. I would say, because the other part of your question had to do with recent events, and clearly things have taken a very concerning turn in Turkey over the last, 10 days. And there is very real and legitimate alarm at not only the response of the government to peaceful protests over the redevelopment of a park in Istanbul, but I think it has, to some degree, perhaps lifted a curtain on a greater degree of concern within significant parts of Turkish society about the degree of freedom that they actually have. So, I think it is of concern. Nobody wants to see Turkey destabilized, and speaking sort of less perhaps in my capacity as a USERF commissioner and simply as a concerned citizen, one hopes to see moderation and a reasonable response from the government so that this crisis can be navigated in an appropriate way. But I would say this in terms of its implications for religious freedom. If one reads the segment of the report that does deal with Turkey, it states very clearly that we think the situation in Turkey merits ongoing vigilance and rather close monitoring. And that's not only a reflection of the fact that there are still pretty big issues out there. The Halki Seminary has not been reopened. The properties of the Mor Gabriel Monastery have not been returned in their entirety. And, you know, there are a variety of issues which we address in that section. And against the backdrop of some of these recent events, I can assure you that that vigilant sort of oversight of what's going on in Turkey will, if anything, be heightened.
Right, thank you. Well, I just want to thank you for your concern for and your support of the Ecumenical Patriarchate.
Thank you so much, and thank you for your excellent question.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Anne Bewalda with the Jubilee Campaign.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I appreciate it. And I would like to address my question specifically on the report on Nigeria. We are grateful and we applaud your, again, calling for a country of particular concern designation of Nigeria. We believe that's very, very important. Now, in carefully reviewing the report that you submitted, unfortunately, we detect at least 20 really significant errors in our opinion as an organization, and we'll be submitting to you a very detailed analysis of what we have noticed as erroneous. And along that line, I have a question regarding specifically the use of the word sectarian violence. In the report on Nigeria, the use of the word would indicate that there's basically Muslim versus Christian violence taking place in Nigeria, and that is very inconsistent and contrary to the number of attacks. Another point is that basically there were not less attacks in 2012 and in 2011 by Boko Haram. That's just completely erroneous. But on the issue of sectarian violence, I know that that term may mean different things to different people, but the implication is somehow victims are responsible as well. And in our view, in our analysis, that's just not the case in Nigeria. So I'm interested to know how you use the term sectarian violence and why you would use it when there are innocent victims involved on religious violence.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, let me just say that we would very much welcome getting sort of the detailed analysis that you referred to, because I think we're humble enough to acknowledge we don't always get every detail right. Again, you know, we don't have all the resources at our command, and we do rely and to some degree have to rely on interlocutors and people that we can deal with who have the ability to be on the ground in different countries, because that, while we are able to make trips to countries and have, you know, had delegations who have gone to meet with people in specific countries, we're not there all the time and we just don't have the resources. So we would welcome that. We try to be open to, you know, not only constructive criticism, but corrections when called for. And so please, we will welcome that and we'll look for that and appreciate it. On the issue of sectarian violence and how that term is used, if I understand your question correctly, we did not mean to suggest, and it is not the case that there's sort of an equivalence in violence between, you know, communities. We understand that there has been targeting of Christian communities by Boko Haram and in some instances of Muslims that oppose the tactics and the terror being advanced by Boko Haram. And so that is not our intention to create that impression. I don't know, Elizabeth, if you would like to add something here in terms of the way in which we, you know, we're using the language in that context.
Sure. Just to add on what Katrina said, I mean, what we tried to set out in the report, and you know, there are separate sections, so this is because there are two different issues. In our section where we're talking about sectarian violence, we're talking about, you know, things that have, violence that has been going on for years. I mean, you know, since the late 90s, and 14,000 or so people have been killed, and that is sort of sometimes sectarian violence, communal violence, violence between communities within society, different from the Boko Haram phenomenon, which has arisen more recently. So those are instances where, and a lot of times it's tied up with other issues as well, you know, there's some kind of a dispute that escalates into violence, and, you know, there have been some larger scale incidents, there have been some smaller scale incidences, and the government historically and still in Nigeria has not prosecuted the perpetrators of that violence, and that violence has gone both ways. Sometimes it's Muslims against Christians, sometimes it's Christians against Muslims, and they haven't prosecuted very many cases in either case. Then Boko Haram is a group that's arisen more recently, and they definitely target Christians in a different way than they target Muslims. I mean, as we say in the report, they've targeted Christian churches, they've targeted Christian, you know, places. They also target the police, the government, et cetera. So that's, and, you know, maybe we didn't use the sections as artfully as we could have to make clear that they are sort of different phenomenon. They're related in a way because Boko Haram does use sort of sectarian communal attacks sometimes to justify its attacks on Christians. It argues that it's retaliating for Christian attacks on Muslims. So they're related, but they also have some different aspects. And we tried to we tried to bring that out in the report, but perhaps we didn't do it as clearly as we could have.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Alan Hertzegi with the University of Oklahoma.
Hello, Katrina. Congratulations on a tremendous effort and a great report and all your fine work. I did have a question.
I want to just pay tribute to you, Alan. You're certainly one of the great thinkers and writers and leaders in this field. So, and thank you for your outstanding work.
Well, you're welcome. I had a question about your recommendation on Vietnam. As you know, there are some NGOs that have felt, who work in Vietnam, who have felt that the government has made some progress, that perhaps it doesn't designate CPC status in comparison to some of the other countries. And I'm wondering about both the deliberation of the Commission on Vietnam and your conviction that it should be designated as a CPC, and your difference of opinion with the State Department on that.
Well, you know, it's a good question, and Vietnam presents the situation that some of the other countries also present, where one sees, sort of looking at the country as a whole, some pretty significant and notable positive changes over a period of time. I think Burma in this last, you know, period of a year or so is an example of that as well. But when we drill down and kind of look at what are the practices and conditions that had, you know, called for this kind of designation, they are still very severe and egregious and systematic. I mean, in Vietnam, the things we were looking at was imprisoning individuals for religious activity or for advocating for religious freedom, the existence of this specialized religious police force, and something that, you know, happens in Vietnam as well as in some other places is utilizing these sort of somewhat vague national security laws to suppress and persecute independent religious communities, whether that be Protestant or Buddhist or Tao Dai. And then, of course, their efforts to hold back the growth of minority Protestant and Catholic movements, using societal discrimination, violence, and then very problematically forced renunciations of faith. There was discussion about this amongst the commissioners. It was, though, I think, quite, there was a fairly, good consensus that on balance we did feel it merited this designation. I don't know, Elizabeth, would you like to add something there? And, just one other thought that, as it relates to USERF versus the State Department, we consider ourselves, not surprisingly, I suppose, to be the gold standard on these issues of designation. And we don't say that necessarily critically of the State Department, but we understand that we have the luxury of having a laser beam-like focus on religious freedom issues. The State Department is, of necessity, balancing a much larger and more complex portfolio. And so they factor in a whole bunch of other matters when they make their decisions about how to designate countries. And, we understand that they need to do that, but believing as strongly as we do that securing religious freedom will advance the rest of our foreign policy goals, we are not reluctant when we feel it's warranted to from, the conclusions the State Department reaches and, to exert what influence we have to try and persuade them to take our position. And Elizabeth, you probably have something to add to all that.
Well, just to expand on something you said, I mean, for us, for the CPC recommendation, it's particularly important that there continue to be people in prison for their either religious practice or religious freedom advocacy, as well as continued reports of forced renunciation of faith, particularly amongst ethnic minorities. And, of course, Alan, the government had supposedly, enacted a policy of no forced renunciations of faith when the CPC was lifted. While there was some progress at that point, we've seen backsliding.
Yeah, and, and if you back a little bit of the history with Vietnam, I think that, if I'm not mistaken, the CPC designation dates back a ways, 2004, and it actually spurred useful and productive discussions on religious freedom that did bring at that time some improvements on the ground. So, I think obviously countries, none of whom want to be listed as a CPC, tend to view it as something perhaps a public rebuke, and it is in some senses a rebuke, but it's also viewed from a different lens, an opportunity to prompt and promote and maybe even provoke discussion and the marshaling of political will both on the side of the United States but on the side of these countries, political will to address these issues and to think about whether or not there are changes they're prepared to make, not only to get off the CPC list, but much more importantly, to improve and strengthen the, health of the dynamic for religious freedom in their countries.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from David Wildman with United Methodist.
Yes. Hi. Let me just add my thanks and appreciation for the report, and I've appreciated past reports too, the commission is doing great work. I want to ask about a particular set of countries that often have military alliances with the U.S. government. So if you look at Pakistan, Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, Saudi Arabia, a number of the countries, Egypt, there's also ways in which we are easing restrictions on Uzbekistan because we need to use that as a pipeline for withdrawal of material and troops from Afghanistan. But so I want to ask, has the commission looked at the impact of where we have these, you know, sort of arms, whether it's arms sales or military aid or sort of waiving of congressional sanctions in the case of Uzbekistan, that this is having a detrimental effect in terms of the efforts around religious freedom that you have put forth and your concerns around a number of these countries?
Well, you know, look, it's a very sophisticated question, and I think that it kind of gets back to what I was saying in response to Alan Hirschke, and that is that, you know, the State Department and the Obama administration, any presidential administration is more prone to somewhat perhaps trim their sails when it comes to robustly addressing religious freedom concerns when they are dealing with countries that, as you say, there's a military, connection, treaty, cooperation that's required, or other significant foreign policy concerns that seem to preempt and take precedence over the need to address religious freedom issues. What I would say is that our view is that in general, when we as a government take the short view rather than the long view on these matters of principle and human rights and religious freedom, we often pay a price in the long run. And so, you know, in a broader philosophical sense, I think we would say, don't make the mistake, and now I'm addressing myself to, you know, policymakers in the various branches of our government, don't make the mistake of thinking religious freedom is a quote-unquote soft issue, because failure to address it successfully will create very real, very quote-unquote hard challenges for us in the national security arena. So, I think you are correctly identifying a reluctance on the part of some of the branches of our government to appear to press hard or advance hard religious freedom concerns with countries where we also have many, many other concerns related to security and military needs and transport, et cetera, et cetera. And our argument would be to them that is a short-term perspective that can come back to bite us, and that we are not harming these societies. I mean, we're doing them a favor by pressing them to get this part of their civil society, if you will, right, because they will become, for us, for the United States, more stable, more dependable, more peaceful allies in the long run if we can help them through pressure and through incentives and through, you know, the various tools in the toolbox to do a better job of creating a climate where religious freedom is protected.
Thank you. I wonder if you could also just say a word about Syria, because much of the congressional debate right now, I know you did a report, is on military aid or not, which to me is like militarizing the problem solving. And to say really, I was just in Lebanon with Christians meeting, and many of them are between a rock and a hard place in terms of the regime and the opposition. That are there other ways of strengthening religious freedom and affirming that aren't militarized, you know, linked with the violent extremism, there's also a kind of tendency to militarize problem solving in tragic situations like a place like Syria.
Well, you know, it is a tragic situation, and, you know, that's one reason why we sort of wanted to issue the report we did on Syria somewhat separately from the general report. Well, for a couple of reasons. One reason is that that until civil war degenerated in the last, period of time, while Syria was by no means an exemplar of religious freedom, there was a relative degree of sort of mutual cohabitation, if you will, peaceful coexistence between some of the minority religious communities and the majority religious community. And that what we think is happening is that as part of a whole series of objectives in this brutal civil war, The Syrian government has begun fanning the flames of sectarian violence and hatred, feeling, you know, that that in some ways is going to help them in their effort to hold on to power. So it is a really, really disturbing situation. And we think, you know, again, yet another example of how these religious respect and freedom issues left untended or left, you know, left in the hands of dictators are going to degenerate and morph into really great problems. I don't know that I feel competent to address the whole issue of militarization and whether or not it's appropriate for us to consider, you know, arming the opposition forces. That is to some degree outside of sort of our area of expertise. But Elizabeth, would you like to respond in terms of some of the ideas we put forth in our Syria report?
Sure, yeah. And we put out a Syria report in April. It's available on our website. It came out just a couple of weeks before the annual report. So I'd urge you to take a look at that. But essentially, as Katrina mentioned, you know, we saw an increasingly sectarian nature of the conflict and became increasingly worried about what this meant, both for what's going on now, but also for the future of Syria. And, you know, like Katrina says, we come at these things from a human rights angle and religious freedom angle. So, you know, the militarization and the arming is kind of beyond our scope, but a lot of the focus of the report had to do with recommendations and things that the U.S. government should be thinking about trying to sort of defray or avoid some of the worst outcomes on human rights and religious freedom that, you know, could flow from all of this. So, efforts to ensure that, you know, the post-Assad government isn't a violent extremist government, you know, protecting religious freedom and human rights for all Syrians, and things like that. So we have a number of recommendations on that regard, and I should say we're continuing to follow the situation very closely, and in fact have two staffers right now who are on a trip with UNHCR interviewing Syrian refugees in a number of countries in the region.
And, you know, and we think it's really important that as our government wrestles with the conundrum of how to respond in Syria now that the civil war involves much more ambivalent sort of profiles to the two sides than existed early on, you know, when this was a peaceful uprising, that the planning, and this goes to our broader point that, you know, the administration has to view religious freedom as a key pillar in the way they approach these foreign policy challenges. And part of the long-term plan for Syria, because eventually this civil war and this, you know, bloody, open, you know, deadly conflict will come to an end. But if it does not come to an end with a basis for, religious freedom, real respect and protection for all religious communities within Syria, real safety and security for all the religious communities in Syria, it will not last. It will be short-lived. It will split apart again and again. So we really believe that, beyond the immediate tragedy of what's unfolding, the planning for a post-Assad Syria must include prioritizing the protection of religious freedom along with other fundamental human rights for the Syrian people.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, Elizabeth and Katrina, and to everybody, we are out of time. This hour has passed much too quickly, and we greatly appreciate your insights and analysis and recommendations. So thank you very much for being with us today, for your work to produce this report and to lead the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom.
Well, we thank you, all of the participants, and thank you for the excellent questions and dialogue. And, I would, and particular thanks to you, Irina, and your team who do such a terrific job with these programs. But I would just say that I always feel somewhat inspired and uplifted when I have the chance to talk to people such as those gathered on this phone call today. At some level, you know, we're fellow travelers that understand that protecting this most fundamental of human rights, this right of conscience, which goes to the very essence of our integrity of as human beings, is really worthy and important work. And so it is, it's enormously encouraging to us to know that people of this caliber are out there reading the report and looking for ways to advance the cause that we're so committed to. So we thank you for that, and best wishes to everyone who's been on the call.
Thank you both, and thank you all. Just as a reminder, we sent out the link in advance, but you can also read the Commission's annual report by going to their website, www.uscirf.gov. As you know, this conference call is part of CFR's Religion and Foreign Policy Initiative, seeking to connect religious and congregational leaders and scholars from across the country in a broad range of pressing international issues, conversations on those things. We appreciate your feedback and suggestions. You can email us at outreach@cfr.org if you would like us to take on any topics or make recommendations. So thanks all to you for being on this call.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.